Usually when we talk about a medical diagnosis, there is this profound expectation of precision.
Oh, absolutely. We really crave that kind of mechanistic certainty.
Right. Like you go into a clinic with a throbbing pain in your forearm, the technician runs you through the X-ray machine, and within minutes, the doctor clips that film onto the light board.
Yeah, and they point to a very specific jagged white line and say, well, there it is. That is the fracture.
Exactly. It is binary. It is clean. The problem is visible, and because it's categorized, there's a clear mechanical protocol for fixing it.
You just put it in a cast, keep it still, let the bone knit. It provides this tremendous psychological relief, you know.
It really does. But then you take a step back. You step out of that clinic and into the world of human society, into the sprawling architecture of our modern institutions.
And suddenly that conceptual X-ray machine is just hopelessly useless.
Completely useless. We are staring at a diagnostic landscape that is incredibly murky. Like you walk into a hospital hoping for healing, and instead you find yourself trapped in this labyrinth of a billing machine.
A machine that seems completely indifferent to your physical pain, Renee.
Exactly. You look at our economies, our educational systems, our political frameworks, and there's this pervasive ambient feeling that things are profoundly sick.
You can feel the fever in the social body,
Yeah.
but you can't point to a single jagged line on a scan to explain why.
You just can't put a cast on a failing healthcare system.
No, you can't. We're swimming in diagnostic muddy waters. And the anxiety that generates in the public is immense because, well, when you cannot accurately name the sickness, you cannot possibly prescribe the cure.
Which is exactly why the framework we are exploring today is so vital. It offers a completely new diagnostic lens.
It really does.
Today, our mission is to take you on an extensive, perspective-altering deep dive into a groundbreaking 2026 academic white paper by Dr. Bichra Seely.
And the title alone gives you a sense of the sheer scale we are dealing with here. It's called From the Biology of Love to Life Coherent Governance.
Yeah, that is a sweeping title.
It is. It's an intellectual paradigm shift that fundamentally rewrites how we understand the relationship between a living organism and the laws that govern it.
And our goal for you listening today is to help you shortcut your way to understanding this radically new framework. Because this paper isn't just some exercise in abstract, lofty political theory.
Not at all. It is a highly practical, granular diagnostic manual.
Right. It's designed to explain exactly why our modern institutions feel broken, why they feel like they're working against us, and more importantly, how we can completely redesign them to support actual human flourishing.
To really grasp the magnitude of this, I want you to picture an incredibly complex, luminous, interconnected web as the visual backdrop for our conversation.
All right, I love a good visual.
Imagine zooming all the way in on one side of this web. You are looking at the microscopic, aqueous world of biological ecosystems, single living cells, the intricate dance of proteins, the raw mechanics of life itself.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Now, follow the threads of that web outward, zooming out continuously until those biological threads seamlessly weave into sweeping human cityscapes.
So you see the concrete and steel of hospitals, the chambers of parliaments, the vast logistical networks of global markets.
Exactly. That image of the microscopic scaling up to the macroeconomic is perfect because this paper achieves something incredibly rare.
It synthesizes the work of four major world-renowned thinkers who essentially bridge the gap between that single cell and that sprawling city.
Right. We are going to be diving into the work of Humberto Maturana, who revolutionized theoretical biology.
Then Johann Galtung, the foundational architect of peace and conflict studies.
John McMurtry, a philosopher who completely dismantled how we measure value.
And Eleanor Ostrom, the Nobel laureate who cracked the code on how complex communities govern shared resources.
It is a monumental intellectual synthesis. It takes the hard rules of biology, runs them through the ethics of philosophy, and applies them directly to political science.
Now, before we really get into the weeds, a quick but very necessary note for you listening. The source material we are unpacking today touches on some inherently charged themes.
Yes, it absolutely does.
By its very nature, analyzing global governance means we are going to be discussing corporate rights, market systems, structural inequality, and institutional power. But I want to be crystal clear.
We have to be.
Our goal in this deep dive is to objectively and meticulously explore the author's theoretical framework without endorsing any political sides. Left, right, center, we aren't taking a stance.
We are not here to play partisan politics or tell you who to vote for.
Exactly. We are just here to unpack the mechanics, the underlying logic, and the philosophical architecture exactly as they are presented in this text.
The focus is purely on understanding the conceptual machinery. We are just looking at the blueprints.
Okay, let's unpack this. To understand how on earth we go about fixing global governance, the paper argues we actually have to throw out our macro lenses entirely.
Right, we have to start under a microscope.
We have to look at the foundational biological rules of single living cells. Which brings us to our first thinker, the biologist Humberto Maturana.
Maturana is really the anchor for this entire philosophical structure. He provides the biological bedrock. In the 1970s, he and his colleague Francisco Varela coined a concept that revolutionized systems biology.
And they called it autopoiesis.
Yes, autopoiesis.
Which is a dense academic word. It sounds like something buried in a postgraduate thesis.
It does sound intimidating.
Yeah.
But the concept behind it is actually incredibly intuitive once you see it. The etymology helps, right? Auto means self, and poiesis means creation or production.
So autopoiesis is literally self-production.
Exactly. Maturana observed that the absolute core characteristic of any living system, whether it's an amoeba, an oak tree, or a human, is that it produces and maintains its own physical boundary and internal organization.
It is an autonomous, closed network of production.
Yes.
Contrast that with how we usually build things. Like, think about a car on an assembly line. The car is not building itself.
No. External machines and human workers are taking raw materials and forcing them into a shape.
Right, based on a blueprint that exists outside the car. The car is structurally determined by its environment. But a living cell doesn't work that way.
Not at all. The cell takes in raw nutrients, sure, but the internal mechanisms of the cell decide how to synthesize those nutrients into the proteins that keep it alive.
The blueprint is entirely internal.
That distinction is paramount. A living system is structurally determined from the inside out. And this biological reality leads directly to Maturana's next crucial concept.
Which is structural coupling, right? Because obviously living systems do not exist in a vacuum.
Right. A cell exists in a bloodstream, a tree in a forest, a human in a society. They are constantly interacting with their environment.
But because they are autonomous, the environment cannot just reach in and dictate their behavior. It can't hand the cell a new blueprint.
What the environment does is perturb the organism. The paper uses the term reciprocal perturbation. When an organism encounters a change, the environment doesn't dictate the response.
It just triggers it.
Exactly. The nature of the response is entirely determined by the organism's own internal structure. And if they interact recurrently over time, they mutually adapt.
They shape each other.
That ongoing dance of mutual adaptation is structural coupling.
Think about the human immune system. When a novel virus enters your body, the virus doesn't hand your white blood cells an instruction manual on how to defeat it.
No, the virus is just a perturbation. It triggers an alarm.
And then your immune system relies entirely on its own internal structural capacity, its own library of antibodies, to formulate a response.
Sometimes it succeeds and adapts. Sometimes the perturbation is too extreme and the structure fails. But the response is always internally generated.
What's fascinating here is the absolute boundary this places on interaction. Because living systems are autonomous, they fundamentally cannot be commanded from the outside.
Right. If you attempt to forcefully impose an external instruction onto an autopoietic system, and you ignore its internal dynamics, you do not achieve genuine coordination.
You get a system failure. You get resistance, massive internal distortion, or you cause catastrophic harm.
It is the biological equivalent of a system crash.
It's like trying to fix a complex, delicate Swiss watch by hitting it with a hammer because you want the gears to turn faster.
Oh, that is a great analogy.
Yeah, like the hammer is a completely external, forceful imposition. It doesn't communicate with the internal structure of the watch.
It doesn't speak the language of springs and cogs.
Right. You might technically make the hand skin wildly for a split second from the blow, giving the illusion of speed, but you have fundamentally destroyed the internal organization.
The hammer violates the structural integrity of the system. Now, the genius of this paper is that it takes Maturana's profound microscopic biological truth and aggressively scales it up.
Into the social realm. It translates cellular autopoiesis into human sociology.
And Maturana actually did this himself through a concept he provocatively named the biology of love.
And we absolutely have to pause and dissect this term because, you know, the word love carries a massive amount of cultural baggage.
It really does.
When we hear love in politics, we think of romantic feelings, utopian poetry, or a naive insistence that everyone just needs to hug it out at the city council meeting.
But the paper makes it painstakingly clear that we are not talking about an emotion or a sentiment here.
Not in the slightest. How does Maturana define it?
In this scientific framework, love is defined with the cold precision of a physical law. It is defined as the relational behavior, the domain of action, where the other is recognized as a legitimate other in coexistence.
A legitimate other in coexistence, that is a heavy foundational phrase. What does that actually look like in practice?
It means interacting with another human being in a way that fully acknowledges their autopoietic autonomy. You accept their existence without an overriding need to control them, extract from them, or force them into a mold.
It is the polar opposite of the hammer on the Swiss watch.
Exactly. When relations are grounded in this, persons and communities are not artificially constrained. They gain broader domains of action. Their capacity to think and innovate is maximized because they aren't bracing against external distortion.
So flip that around. When we organize our societies or workplaces primarily through fear, domination, or relentless coercion, we aren't just being morally callous.
No. The paper argues this is a fundamental biological incoherence. We are acting against the laws of physics that govern living things.
Wow. So when an institution organizes a system through fear, it is actively narrowing the domains of action available to the people.
It forces them into survival modes. It shuts down higher order coupling. The institution is functionally disabling the life capacity of the organisms it's supposed to organize.
Which radically challenges how we define order. You could look at a heavily authoritarian society or even a deeply toxic corporate environment where everyone is kept in line through intense fear.
And surveillance and strict control.
Right. And on the surface, you might say, well, look how orderly it is. The trains are running, quotas are met, there's no visible chaos.
But biologically, that kind of compliance is a highly unstable, distressed adaptation. It requires massive energy to maintain that coercion.
And eventually, inevitably, it leads to system collapse because it is at war with the living systems it's trying to govern.
Fear and domination do not create order. They create a pressurized stasis. They treat human beings not as autonomous living systems, but as raw materials to be hammered.
But wait, if love just means legitimacy of the other, how does that actually translate to passing laws or running a sprawling metropolis?
It's the ultimate pragmatic question.
Yeah, because a city needs traffic laws. It needs taxation, sanitation schedules. If someone is dumping toxic waste into the water supply, you can't just say, well, I recognize your biological autonomy. Keep doing it.
No, you definitely cannot. Governance inherently requires boundaries and enforcement.
How do you bridge that gap?
The framework suggests that to understand how to build complex legal systems based on legitimacy, we first have to look deeply at what happens when legitimacy is denied.
Okay, so we have to map the pathology first.
Right. We need a diagnostic vocabulary for how harm is engineered into the very structures we rely on. We need to understand the anatomy of the hammer before we can invent a better tool.
Which brings us to the architecture of harm, guided by the work of Johann Galtung.
Galtung is essentially the founding father of modern peace and conflict studies. In 1969, and then expanded in 1990, he created a diagnostic tool known as the violence triangle.
And the first point of this triangle is the one we are all intimately familiar with. It's direct violence.
Yes. Direct violence is overt, intentional, and highly visible. It involves a clear actor committing an injury against a clear victim.
The physical assault on the street, the deployment of troops, domestic abuse, or bulldozing a habitat. The cause and effect are undeniable.
But Galtung's massive contribution was pointing out that a society can completely eradicate direct violence, nobody's throwing punches, and still be profoundly violent.
And that is because of the second point on the triangle, structural violence.
Structural violence is insidious precisely because it is invisible to the naked eye. It doesn't require a malicious actor twirling a mustache.
It is harm that is fundamentally built directly into the social structures, legal codes, and economic institutions. It is the institutionalization of unequal life chances.
The paper provides some undeniable examples of this. We are talking about systemic poverty. We are talking about a healthcare system that provides state-of-the-art treatments in one zip code. While a few miles away, people are dying of preventable illnesses.
Because they cannot afford basic preventive care, or exploitative labor conditions where someone works 60 hours a week, destroying their physical autopoiesis through exhaustion, and still can't afford safe housing.
Or environmental racism, zoning toxic waste facilities directly adjacent to marginalized neighborhoods.
In every single one of those scenarios, there is no single person pulling a trigger. The harm is distributed seamlessly across bureaucratic algorithms.
But the result is exactly the same as direct violence. Human beings are injured. Their life capacity is disabled by the social arrangement itself.
And what allows structural violence to operate in plain sight without triggering a massive social revolt?
That is the third point, the psychological glue holding it together. Cultural violence.
Cultural violence is the realm of symbols, narratives, and ideologies. Media framing, prevailing economic theories, religious dogmas. It's the mechanism of normalization.
This is truly terrifying when you start to look for it. How does an advanced society look at sprawling tent cities of unhoused people or irreversible ecological destruction and collectively shrug and say, well, that's just the way the world works?
Cultural violence whispers in our ear, oh, it is economically necessary to maintain unemployment to curb inflation.
Or the media trope that implies those people living next to the chemical plant just didn't work hard enough to move.
Or corporate logic declaring, we have to clear cut this forest because it's the most efficient use of shareholder resources.
The interlocking dynamic here is wild. Cultural violence warps our perception so thoroughly that structural violence isn't even perceived as violence. It's just the cost of doing business.
And when the marginalized populations finally react, often erupting into direct violence out of sheer desperation, the culture immediately points to that direct violence as justification for even more coercive structural control.
It is a closed, toxic feedback loop.
Mm.
And the paper synthesizes this entire dynamic under one chilling term, life disablement.
Any avoidable organization of life conditions that injures or systematically prevents the development of life capacity. It doesn't matter if it's a bullet or a budget cut.
If it reduces capacity to thrive, it is life disablement.
But the paper doesn't just leave us drowning in this diagnosis, thankfully. It flips the triangle to create a positive counterpart, the life coherence triangle.
Yes, let's walk through the anatomy of that positive triangle.
Yeah.
For direct violence, the direct opposite is direct care.
The immediate physical manifestation of the biology of love. Protection from harm, physical healing, trauma-informed emergency responses.
Moving to the structural level, the opposite of structural violence is structural justice.
And in this framework, that's not just an abstract legal feeling of fairness, right?
Exactly. It means engineering institutions that practically secure universal life necessities for every single member of the population. Designing tax codes and environmental regulations whose primary mandate is equitable resource distribution.
Baking the preservation of life into the algorithms of the state. And finally, the antidote to cultural violence is cultural legitimacy.
Prevailing narratives and public education curricula that actively affirm human dignity and our interconnectedness with the biosphere.
So a culture that publicly prizes mutual recognition rather than generating justifications for inequality.
Right.
Now, I have to pause here because I can vividly hear the skepticism of someone listening. Isn't violence a strong word for a bureaucratic failure? Like, if a hospital's billing system denies someone care because of a coding error, is that really on the same moral level as physical assault?
It's a totally valid challenge. We are deeply conditioned to associate violence strictly with intentionality and kinetic physical force.
Right, with malice.
But the paper challenges us to evaluate systems not by their intent, but by their biological outcome. Look at the end result.
If the result of the assault is the shattering of physical capacity and the result of the billing algorithm denying preventative care is exactly the same, the literal loss of life.
Then from a biological standpoint, they are both mechanisms of violence. The only difference is the delivery system.
One delivery system is visceral and leaves blood on the pavement. The other is distributed invisibly across fiber optic cables and sterile boardrooms.
It's bureaucratic, and the CEO never has to look the victim in the eye. But the violence is laundered through the system.
The true measure of violence is the avoidable reduction in viable possibilities for living. So what does this all mean for how we evaluate our systems? If money and efficiency are masking structural violence, what should we be measuring instead?
That foundational question brings us to the work of our third thinker, John McMurtry. He provides the definitive answer through his framework, Life Value, onto axiology.
Onto axiology is one of those philosophical terms that makes you want to immediately close the book.
It really is, but the core concept is a very grounded showdown between two incompatible ways of measuring reality, money value versus life value.
To understand McMurtry, we have to look at the operating system of the global economy. Right now, the absolute ruling sequence is money value.
Under this logic, a thing or a person is only considered valuable if it can be assigned a price, exchanged in a market, and returned as a financial profit.
The ultimate metric of success is the continuous growth of GDP. money is the master metric. If chopping down a forest generates $1 million in lumber sales, the system registers that as 1 million units of good.
The fact that the forest was generating oxygen, filtering water, and housing autopoietic organisms does not register because oxygen doesn't pay a dividend.
McMurtry argues that this logic is fundamentally insane because it has zero grounding in physical biological life. So he proposes a total shift to life value.
Under life value, a social system or corporate action is judged by one uncompromising criterion. Does it enable or disable the range of thought, felt being, and action of living beings?
Thought, felt being, and action. That triad is essentially the definition of what it means to be alive and human.
Right. Right. Yes. The capacity to understand and learn. The capacity to feel dignity, belonging, and joy. The capacity to move, participate, and build.
If an institution expands those capacities, it has high life value. If it contracts them, if it exhausts the workers or numbs the mind, it is actively disabling life, regardless of how profitable it is.
McMurtry is radically shifting the definition of the common interest. Politicians usually frame it as maximizing economic growth or ensuring global market competitiveness.
McMurtry forcefully rejects that. He argues the true common interest is grounded exclusively in what is universally required for life to flourish.
The absolute baseline requirements: clean air, drinkable water, nutrient-dense food, safe shelter, access to knowledge. These are not luxury items.
They are the non-negotiable prerequisites for life capacity, and protecting them leads to perhaps the most powerful concept in the paper, the civil commons.
The civil commons is the physical and social infrastructure of life value. It's all the socially constructed systems society builds to secure universal access to these life necessities, regardless of ability to pay.
When we hear commons, we usually think of a public park. But the paper calls the civil commons the social metabolism of a life-coherent society.
The word metabolism is highly intentional. Think about a healthy biological body. It relies on a continuous metabolism that circulates oxygen from the lungs and nutrients from the gut to every peripheral tissue.
It doesn't charge the liver a fee for oxygen.
Exactly. It circulates what is needed. If a limb is cut off from that circulation, it rapidly begins to necrotize and die.
Applying that biological logic to society, the civil commons is the societal metabolism. It circulates knowledge through public education. It circulates healing through public health networks.
It circulates trust through fair legal protections. And when that civil commons is degraded or privatized, the society literally becomes metabolically disordered.
The circulation stops. People can no longer rely on shared life support. They're forced to seek necessities through private purchase.
If they don't have the money, they go into massive debt or suffer the structural violence of deprivation. The social tissue necrotizes.
To make this incredibly practical, the paper includes a diagnostic tool called the Civil Commons Test.
It's a set of rigorous questions you can ask of any institution or law to determine if it is metabolically healthy. Does it secure or undermine universal life necessities? Does it expand democratic participation?
Here's where it gets really interesting for me. If you apply that test to how our global systems operate, the results are horrifying.
They really are.
It feels like we are running a civilization on a corrupted hard drive. Imagine a massive supercomputer that runs the planet, but its operating system is hard-coded to only process money value.
Oh, that's a brilliant way to put it.
Yeah, if you input a massive data set of life value, like preserving an old-growth forest because it produces oxygen and stabilizes the climate, the system literally cannot read the data.
It registers the biological reality as a computational error, or an externality.
Exactly. The core algorithm is coded strictly for profit, so anything that sustains life without generating financial return is treated as invisible.
Or as an obstacle to be optimized away. When an institution prioritizes its financial survival over its life-enabling mission, it becomes clinically diseased.
Which catapults us directly into the pathology of our modern world.
The paper calls this disease process money sequencing, which leads to institutional capture.
Let's trace how an institution gets captured, because it's a progressive disease, right?
It begins the moment profit margin and growth replace life value as the primary logic. The cycle starts with the rapid concentration of money into the hands of a few.
And in a financialized system, that concentrated money inevitably buys outsized political influence and lobbying power.
Once you have that influence, you change the operating system. You rewrite the laws to systematically favor private extractive interests over the civil commons.
Policy capture. And once the rules are changed, the mass privatization of life goods sets in. municipal water, healthcare delivery, housing markets, they are transformed from shared infrastructure into private assets designed to extract rent.
This leads to the immediate degradation of the commons and perpetual dependence for the citizen.
And tying this back to Galtung, this is where cultural violence does its heavy lifting. This upward transfer of wealth is entirely normalized by the captured media.
The dominant narratives loudly blame the people who are suffering. They didn't save enough, they aren't resilient enough.
While the system suppresses resistance and concentrates more money at the top, it's a runaway train.
The text refers to this terminal stage as civilizational drift or pathological governance. The society continuously conserves the very habits that actively reproduce mass life disablement and calls it an economic necessity.
We interact with this drift every single day. The paper gives such striking examples. Look at the modern hospital system. Its core life mission is the provision of healing.
But under capture, the hospital becomes subordinated to the money sequence. It fiercely conserves its billing departments and debt collection algorithms.
It conserves these even as patients are routinely denied care because they can't afford copays. The corporate institution thrives financially, but comprehensively fails its actual life value purpose.
You see the exact same pathology in public education. A school's vital life mission is to expand a child's cognitive capacity for deep thought.
But under capture, schools become obsessed with standardized testing and administrative metrics because they're tied to funding.
The institution conserves the testing apparatus while the children are stripped of curiosity and trained in bureaucratic compliance.
Or consider our massive global media platforms. Their life mission in a democracy is to circulate accurate information and cultivate a space for public reason.
But their only goal is maximizing shareholder return. So they optimize proprietary algorithms designed for maximum attention capture, usually by amplifying outrage and division.
The tech company achieves a $1 trillion valuation, while the fabric of public reason completely disintegrates.
It functions exactly like a systemic autoimmune disease. The very institutions designed to nourish the social body are essentially attacking the host to feed their own bureaucratic expansion.
And this reality brings up a critical point about human rights. We spend so much energy debating formal rights, the right to health, education, a clean environment.
But the paper points out that a formal right is completely meaningless if the actual civil commons infrastructure required to physicalize that right has been captured or destroyed.
That is profound. You can write the right to health into the Constitution. But if the municipal water pipes are leaching lead, if there are no nurses available because the public health budget was slashed,
that constitutional right is a ghost. It does not exist in material reality. The right to health is nothing without the physical infrastructure of health.
And far too often, abstract corporate rights to intellectual property end up legally superseding the biological life rights of the citizens.
So we have arrived at the bottom of the diagnostic well.
Yeah, the diagnosis is bleak. The systems are structurally violent and captured by money value. How on earth do we govern our way out of this? Because a panicked instinct is to impose a massive authoritarian state to force everyone to do the right thing.
But based on Maturana's biology, we know that external forcing just causes more distortion and collapse. So we have to pivot to the mechanics of a cure, guided by Eleanor Ostrom and Wu-Wei governance.
Let's start with Eleanor Ostrom. Her work is legendary. She won the Nobel Prize for shattering a globally accepted myth about human nature.
For decades, there was this unquestioned binary myth called the tragedy of the commons. It assumed humans are fundamentally selfish utility maximizers, so if a vital resource is shared collectively, individuals will inevitably overextract from it until it's destroyed.
According to that theory, there were only two solutions. Either completely privatize it and sell it to a corporation, or you need a massive, coercive state government to take total ownership and dictate usage.
The free market or the authoritarian state. Those are the only options. But Ostrom refused to accept that without evidence. She went out and studied how real human communities actually manage shared resources.
And she proved, with mountains of data, that the binary was false.
She documented countless examples where communities successfully self-organized and governed durable commons for centuries without privatizing land and without relying on a coercive state command.
But she was clear it wasn't magic. It wasn't just people sitting in a drum circle. They had to develop rigorous conditions for self-governance.
She identified core design principles. There have to be clear, locally meaningful rules. Active monitoring, but the monitors must be the users themselves. Graduated sanctions, mild corrections that escalate if behavior continues.
And collective choice arrangements. The people directly affected must have the power to participate in modifying the rules.
So, taking Ostrom's proven framework, the papal merges it with non-forcing politics, or wu-wei governance. Wu-wei is an ancient Taoist concept translated as non-action, but here, it absolutely does not mean doing nothing.
Right. If we connect this to the bigger picture, wu-wei is the political realization of Maturana's biology. Living systems are autonomous, so wu-wei means acting in a way that aligns with that autonomy.
It is the profound art of action without domination, intervening by shaping the environment rather than forcing the organism.
So instead of a centralized government dictating a 500-page rigid blueprint, what does wu-wei actually look like in the real world?
It requires a massive shift in the role of public institutions. The required interventions often take the form of profound restraint and removal, using state power to actively stop extractive corporate practices, dismantling architectures of structural violence,
and radically redistributing the fundamental means of life, ensuring universal access to the civil commons so people have the metabolic health to actually participate in Ostrom-style self-organization.
It's about designing institutions that are structurally mandated to listen, with sensitive feedback loops, continuously learning and adapting alongside the population.
It's a radical shift from viewing a government as a military commander enforcing rigid order from a control tower to viewing the government as a master gardener.
I love that.
A gardener doesn't reach into the soil, grab a seed, and manually pull the stem out by force. That would destroy the seed.
The gardener's entire job is to protect the soil, remove toxic elements, ensure water and light, defend the perimeter from pests, and then step back to allow the ecosystem to self-organize according to its own biological structure.
But wait, I have to ask the hard question here. There's a real danger in romanticizing the local community. History shows us local communities can be incredibly oppressive, exclusionary, and structurally violent.
Absolutely.
Look at local segregation laws. If we move toward Ostrom's model and wu-wei governance, how does this prevent a local Lord of the Flies scenario where a majority dominates a marginalized minority?
It is the most critical safeguard in the text. Sihirli explicitly warns against this naive romanticization. Ostrom's contribution is that self-organization is a durable mechanism, but in this framework, it is only legitimate when it is strictly nested within the universal metric of life value.
So the local community has the autonomy to decide the logistics of how to manage their water basin, but they fundamentally do not have the right to decide to cut off the water supply to a specific neighborhood.
Exactly, because that action instantly violates the universal baseline requirement of life value. McMurtry's criterion acts as the absolute, non-negotiable ethical boundary.
If a locally decided rule disables life capacity for any group, it is biologically and legally illegitimate. Wu-wei doesn't mean might makes right. It means expertly stewarding the necessary conditions for all life to flourish.
Precisely.
Okay, so if we are going to attempt to shift society toward this gardener model and operate strictly on life value, how do we practically measure if we are succeeding? Because GDP has to go in the trash.
This brings us to the practical toolkit provided in the paper, the Life Coherent Governance Dashboard.
This is where the soaring theory hits the pavement of public policy. The dashboard has 10 specific, measurable criteria to evaluate any system.
The absolute first non-negotiable criterion is, does the system comprehensively protect universal life necessities? The concrete provision of water, food, shelter, healthcare, and education.
So if a new economic policy promises a 10% GDP increase, but the reality is 1% of the population loses access to clean water, it fails immediately.
The policy is rejected, regardless of the financial windfall. Criterion two, does the system actively reduce violence in all its forms?
And that means actively dismantling the structural deprivation embedded in the tax code and countering cultural narratives that justify poverty.
Another pivotal metric is criterion three. Does the system expand life capacity? Does it tangibly foster coherent, expansive ranges of thought, felt being, and action?
So if a corporation introduces a new gig economy labor model that traps workers in exhausting, precarious labor just to afford groceries, it utterly fails this criterion.
Because it physically and mentally contracts their capacity to think and participate as autopoietic beings.
The dashboard also includes a strict mandate for protecting ecological integrity. It treats the natural environment not as an external resource to sell, but as the literal foundational life support condition for the entire civil commons.
There is also a criterion dedicated to preventing institutional capture, requiring extreme transparency, breaking up concentrated power, and strict firewalls between corporate wealth and political policy.
And I find this one incredible. Protecting future generations. Intergenerational equity. Are we making decisions that ensure a metabolically healthy world for those born a century from now?
Let's look at how the text applies this dashboard to real-world sectors. Take the health sector. A genuinely life-coherent health system doesn't wait for you to develop chronic asthma from environmental toxins and then sell you a highly profitable pharmaceutical intervention.
Right. It actively protects the foundational conditions of health first, mandating safe housing, clean water, outlawing air pollution.
And the education sector. Under this dashboard, a life-coherent education system is no longer an industrial sorting factory stamping kids with a grade based on compliance.
It's redesigned as a protected space, fostering genuine independent thought, deep imagination, and robust cognitive ability.
The paper even applies this to the evolving world of tech and artificial intelligence. Algorithms are not neutral mathematical tools.
Right. If a piece of AI tech intensifies surveillance, manipulates human behavior to drive ad revenue, or systematically de-skills workers, that algorithm is a political niche actively degrading human life capacity.
It is a digital hammer hitting the biological watch. And regarding climate change, the biosphere is the literal foundation of the house. You do not negotiate with the foundation if you want the house to remain standing.
Now, before we close, the author details a few crucial safeguards so this framework isn't warped by bad actors.
Yes, these are vital. First, we must never reduce complex human politics strictly to biological determinism. Biology is the foundation, but human society still requires cultural nuance, legal rights, and continuous democratic debate.
Second, we must be courageous enough to name power. The structural violence devastating our world isn't an oops moment. It actively benefits specific actors and entrenched power structures.
If we want change, we have to be intellectually honest about who is profiting from the disease. And finally, we must radically expand our circle of ethical concern.
A truly life-coherent model cannot be strictly anthropocentric. It inherently includes all non-human life and the integrity of the planetary biosphere.
We can't just create a perfect utopia for humans while strip mining the oceans. That's just conserving a delayed kind of extraction.
Imagine taking this 10-point life value dashboard and applying it tomorrow morning to your own workplace. Does your company expand your capacity for thought, felt being, and action? Or does it intentionally organize your daily labor through exhaustion, fear, and financial precarity just to maximize money value for distant shareholders?
The implications are deeply uncomfortably personal because these macro structures dictate the microscopic reality of our everyday lives.
Shifting to this new paradigm requires a fundamental reimagining of our daily role on this planet, which brings us to the final synthesis of our journey. We have covered an immense amount of intellectual terrain today.
We truly have. We have traced a magnificent ethical and political arc, starting from autopoiesis, the self-producing biological reality of living systems. We moved into the biology of love, recognizing the legitimacy of the other as the only viable way to coexist.
We stared unflinchingly at the dark inversion of that through Galtung's violence triangle, mapping how structural and cultural violence disable life capacity, and we found the metabolic antidote in McMurtry's Civil Commons.
And finally, we arrived at the blueprint for life-coherent governance, guided by Ostrom's proof that we can govern the commons. The future of politics must be the meticulous, non-forcing stewardship of the conditions of life, the Wu-Wei coordination of society.
I want to speak directly to you listening right now. If you ever find yourself doom-scrolling the news and you feel this rising tide of being overwhelmed, of intense anxiety, or even feeling physically sickened by our political and economic systems, This entire framework proves your anxiety is not a personal failing.
You are not weak, and you are not crazy.
Your anxiety is a completely rational, biologically appropriate reaction to living within structures of violence and life-disabling institutions. Because you are structurally coupled to your environment, your body is correctly diagnosing that the social metabolism is diseased. You are feeling the friction of the money sequence grinding against your autopoietic nature.
This raises an important question. If we now possess the vocabulary to diagnose that our institutions are sick and external hammers won't fix them, how do we actually begin the process of metabolic healing?
That is the ultimate question. Structural coupling works both ways. Our environment shapes us, but we also shape it through our recurrent daily interactions. Every single day, your participation is either feeding the money sequence or actively nurturing the civil commons. But consider the technology you hold in your hand right now. We are increasingly coupling with artificial intelligence algorithms programmed with unyielding devotion to money value metrics like engagement and ad revenue. If our biology adapts to the environment it interacts with, and we spend hours a day coupling with a digital environment fundamentally hostile to our life capacity, are we inadvertently adapting to become more machine-like and easily extracted from?
We really might be.
And if so, how do we intentionally interrupt that specific coupling tomorrow? Think of just one digital or physical system you interact with every single day, the algorithm that feeds your news, your company's productivity tracker, your bank. If you had the absolute power to rebuild it using the Life Value Dashboard tomorrow morning, what is the very first rule you would change? Thank you so much for dedicating your cognitive capacity to join us on this massive deep dive into the architecture of a better world. We leave you to ponder your profound role as a steward of life.